better, they can do things better, and East Germans need to catch up. And that's an imbalance in the way that people perceive one another in Germany that hasn't really gone away. I'm not sure all East Germans feel like as though they are second-class citizens, but a majority do, and surveys show that time and time again when people are asked that exact question. There are some interesting statistics out there in that, for instance, it's under 2% of leadership positions in media and politics and the economy are actually held by East Germans, when in fact they make up a fifth of the population. And that really shows. I mean, I experience this on a regular basis, being sort of East German myself. I've unlearned my local dialect, which is sort of a broad Berlin dialect, because it's immediately associated with sort of being East German. And that comes with certain stereotypes. For instance, I was told by a West German journalist before that I had a nice East German accent, when that's just a peculiar thing to say, given that there are lots of East German accents that all sound very different depending on which region you're from. Whilst I would never in return say to somebody from Bavaria that they've got a nice West German accent, I'd say they've got a Bavarian accent. And it's also pretended that everything that happened in West Germany is all German history. So anniversaries are sort of celebrated of things that happened in the West, but not of things that happened in the East, because they're not part of all German history, and that's how it's perceived. So it is an ongoing issue, and one that even Angela Merkel, the former chancellor, mentioned in her last speech in office in 2021, where she said even in her office, even the position that she held as chancellor for 16 years, she found that the life that she'd led in the GDR was often seen as a kind of skeleton in the cupboard, something that is best not talked about, and a drawback, really, a negative aspect of her life that she'd managed to overcome. And she was praised for that, and she sort of bristled at that and said, well, you know, this was half of my life that you're talking about. So that is still very much a thing that East Germans feel as though they're not really valued in the same way that former West Germans are.
This is part 3 of Good Fences Make Good Neighbors, or Do They? A series of programs about borders, walls, and fences, visible or invisible, that keep us in, keep us out, and keep us divided.
So going to East Berlin from West Berlin back in the 70s and 80s, well, I'm trying to think. So my best friend there was West Berlin, and I think for a while, maybe she couldn't even do it, but I could, and you used to have to change 5 marks, only 5, and then they would let you in. And one of the times I went, like, I had this boyfriend from Prague. I mean, we were close from when I lived there, but then we kept in touch, and we always loved each other, and we're so fond. And so the only way we could see each other when I was in Berlin is if he went to East Berlin and I went to West Berlin. But also it was such that I had, no matter what time I went over, at midnight I had to go back, because you could only get a visa for a day if you were coming from West Berlin. And I didn't get anything ahead of time. That was the deal. So I would go over in the afternoon and we would spend the day together and stuff. But we wanted to spend the night together too. So he would always bring me to the border, and I would go through the East German border back into West Germany and then just turn around and go again. And then they got their 5 marks again, and then we would be able to spend the next 24 hours together. I never did it for, he could never stay more than maybe one or two nights, but I remember always, there was a whole bunch of us who were just going this way through the, you know, east to west, and then back again right away to the east. And so we had to do that. And I remember this friend of mine, Petra, she lived one time in, it was called Günzelstraße, and she was like on the third floor of this apartment. And the S-Bahn, there was the city, there were two different streetcars, and the S-Bahn was the one that actually went, the tracks went to East Berlin. So I saw it in West Berlin, but every time I saw it, it had just been two stops before in East Berlin. And every day I just saw this tram go that had been, you had to, everybody in East Berlin had to always get out there. And then suddenly it was in West Berlin. And then it went back to East Berlin. And it just kind of blew my mind that I was so close to this other existence that was completely denied for the East Germans to come to the West. And Petra and I had this friend in East Berlin, and Petra and I, then it became possible for her to go, and we would go together. But again, going through the transit at the East-West Berlin border, the West Berliners had to go a different way. And so I went through mine, and she had her car, and we had baked a cake to have Kaffee and Kuchen with this friend of ours. So we go, I go this through the one, and it takes just a few minutes, just as long as the line is, and then we had a meeting point. Okay, so I'm waiting, and we didn't have nothing. You're just waiting, and you don't know, and I waited for a really long time, and then suddenly she shows up in her car. She had a kind of a strange look on her face, but it also was a look that says, don't ask me any questions. So, okay. So we go to our friend and we have the Kaffee and Kuchen, and it was really fun and stuff. And then going back, we had to do the same thing, but didn't take as long. So I went already right through, and then she goes a little longer, and then we meet. And I didn't ask her, but then she told me a little later, she said, you know, they strip searched me and they x-rayed the cake to be sure I didn't have anything in the cake. And it was very upsetting for her that they made her strip search, you know, on the way in. And she said, I just couldn't tell you about it then. I just realized how the hierarchy, I mean, I was American, so it was easy. If you were German but not in West Berlin, it was not quite as easy, but easier. And then West Berliners were just, because so many of them had family and this, and was there money baked into the cake, and or razors, or who knows what, information. And so that really shook me up. That's that other story. My friend Bernd, who was the one that showed up at the house, at the apartment when he first escaped, he had just escaped, and he told me his escape story too. He had somehow in East Berlin met some American soldiers. I don't know how, the American soldiers were drinking in a bar or something, and I don't know, they were up for an adventure. And I don't know how many visits it took for them to do this, but they agreed to help him cross the border. And so what they ended up doing was giving him kind of an American haircut as close as they could, and they gave him one of their officer's suits. So he was dressed in an American uniform. And he said, generally we're lucky. We just kind of, they know us, and we just kind of wave through, and they just wave us through. And so it was a risk they took, but he was dressed in an American officer's suit and was in the car with all these real American officers, and then they just waved through, and that's how he got in. And it makes you wonder how many stories there are like that. They're all good and unique.
Thank you. My name is Keon. I'm the husband of Zach, your other interviewee. I'm originally from New York City. I lived there until I went off to college, really, with about a year gap in North Carolina. I've mostly grown up in cities, or prefer cities. I guess relevant to borders, I am mostly, I guess, pro-open borders. So I guess that's the on the political end. But I'm curious to see where the other... I know you guys said you are a little broad with this topic, so I'm curious to see where else it goes. I think copying something like the European Union would work fine here. So that would be kind of a free movement regime between us and Canada and Mexico and other countries in North America and the Caribbean. I think that would be like a good start. The U.S. is a relatively empty country. Like, we're a huge country and the population density is very low. So we have a lot of empty space. So there's no risk of running out of space or being like tightly crammed in with new people. A growing economy needs more workers. The people who come to the country usually want jobs and they need to rent or buy property and they need to buy food and things like that. So they're contributing to the economy just by coming here to work and buy things. That kind of thing creates more jobs, of course. So it's not a zero-sum game having more people here. They come here to support us and we support them. It's kind of a mutual beneficial relationship. I came upon this kind of thinking through libertarianism. And I got interested in that ism on the economic side. I didn't really come to it from the, I guess, the crazy side. You know, if I could say that. I came to it through the side that talks about international trade and economic growth. And I like that kind of thing. And I was like, oh, this sounds pretty great. I came to the crazy side a little after that. You know, but open borders and free movement is part of that economic package of boosting the economy and putting more money in all of our pockets. So that's how I came to it. I lean more libertarian than leftist, but I guess I'm still part of the broad left umbrella. Like, I still support liberal causes or leftist causes or democratic causes or whatever, which I know is also rare for someone who's considered a libertarian. But I think there's more room for compromise between the two sides than not, and especially on an issue like this. Here in the U.S. is interesting because I know the Biden administration has recently put a law into practice where certain countries like Haiti and Venezuela and some of the Central American countries will take in about 30,000, I want to say, I'm not sure if it's asylum or migrants, we'll take in 30,000 of their citizens and they can live here and work here. And I think we take in 30,000 every year or month or something like that. So we already have like the bones of a kind of migratory relationship with these countries. On the flip side, we've also hardened the border so that illegal immigrants can't come in. So it's kind of like a dual kind of like, let's make it a little easier to make it, let's make regulation and legality side a little easier, but hardening the illegal migration side. So I can see us going in either direction. I think the country is so partisan now, it's hard to say what will be the long term, who will win that contest in the end. But at least on the Democratic Party side, I can see kind of the bones of something EU-like or expanding outward, but it's still kind of early days, I think. I guess like open borders, like globally, I feel like a world where everyone was willing to do that would be so radically different. Like it would never happen now. There's just not enough interest for it to happen now. But you know, I guess in just imagining it, we'd be a lot richer. First of all, allowing, because you have a situation now where people in poor countries are locked there. They want to work, they want to earn, they want to, you know, bring in more income, but they can't leave because they can't get the visas to come to the U.S. or go to Europe. So they're stuck there. And on our side, we have huge labor demand, especially for the kind of jobs that no one wants, you know. So there is opportunity for a link there. But for political reasons, we don't accept that link. So if we had open borders around the world, people would just flow to naturally where the jobs are. You know, the market would be more efficient, essentially. And we'd all be better off for it, I think. We do definitely adopt a lot of policies that impoverish other countries, and then we don't give them the opportunity to at least mitigate that by letting them come here and earn money and send the money back. A very unjust kind of situation, for sure. I could be just like maybe daydreaming a little too much, but I feel like that is a case where liberals, or economic liberals, I guess, and leftists could actually cooperate. Liberals have an interest in expanding market access abroad and going to other countries and making money, and leftists have an interest in like ensuring workers have good conditions. And I feel like they spend so much time fighting each other, but I feel like there has to be a way to like cooperate. I read an article recently about the U.S. trying to convince African countries to let U.S. companies invest in their countries. And one of the things they said that was interesting, the U.S. said, our companies are different because our companies pay good wages and have pensions and benefits, unlike the example of Chinese companies, for example, you know? And I'm like, that right there is a liberals on the left getting along. The liberals want to go into countries, make money. The left wants to ensure people are paid right. Why not do that in other countries? I'm sure people also migrate if they're being persecuted in their home countries. Maybe they migrate just because they want some adventure. I'm sure there must be a few people who are just, you know, daredevils like that. But I would probably guess the main reason is economic. Especially if you're hiking across deserts and jungles and swimming across, like, you know, rafting across big ocean. Like, yeah, you need to be pretty desperate to do something like that. If you're a farmer and the soil dries up, what do?
Yeah.
You leave. I feel like for a global passport, it would probably have to be something operated by the UN, I would guess. I guess because they're the only global institution capable of doing something like that. I guess you can create like another. Yeah, honestly, no, just the UN. That's the only one I can see it working, you know?
Yeah.
I've looked into that. It's kind of just like a symbol, and it doesn't mean anything, but it is a fun idea. Part of me does think that we as humans crave some kind of group to belong to, whether that group is innate based on the nation or based on sexuality or religion. It could be anything, you know? It could be based on me wearing green jacket, you know, the Green Jacket Club. You know, it could be anything in the world. But I think the desire to belong to something doesn't necessitate forceful exclusion. Like, I might identify as a Californian. It doesn't mean I'm going to keep out people from Nevada. I'm still willing to work with Nevadans and make money together and have a good time. So I don't think there has to be a contradiction between wanting to belong to a group and being willing to live, work, love other groups. I would say most of my friends are on the left. I'm not sure if immigration issues are like top of mind for them. I think they might have like other concerns that are top of mind for them. But I would say in general, they're supportive of easier immigration and kind of reforming the system to make it not as convoluted and exclusionary as it is now. But I don't know if they're full open borders. That I'm not sure. I can't say for sure either way. I would doubt it. It's a rare position, so I would naturally doubt it, I think. Well, I guess there's kind of a fear on both sides, right? Like, plenty of Americans have fears about foreigners coming to the country and changing our culture and imposing their views on us or bringing economically competing with us. So we kind of share the same fears to some extent. There's a power asymmetry there in the case of America and Mexico or America and Syria, you know, and I can't ignore that. But the fears are similar, and I think it is true that in this kind of case, both cultures would have some kind of shift. There would be some kind of change. There would be economic competition between the parties. That is real. That is something that should be considered. Since I do lean libertarian, I don't really mind economic competition. That kind of seems just like the natural state of things. That seems to be good. But I'm sure leftists might disagree, and they might have some policy recommendations to mitigate the damage of competition. And I'd be fine with that. Except I can't make those recommendations because I'm not a leftist, but I would be willing to leave that to them.
Like you and I do, brush their teeth and go to work like you and I do, call their mom to say hello like you and I do, rest their head when they are home like you and I do.
How can you have popsicles at a time like this? July 2018. The cab slowed as we turned off the pavement onto a rough dirt road on the northern edge of Tijuana. Dust rose around us as we rolled past empty warehouses, shacks, and lots full of abandoned big rigs. There was trash piled on the shoulder twice the height of the car. "If men appear in the road in front of us," the driver said in Spanish, "we will turn around." I didn't quite trust my comprehension, especially over the sound of the wind and radio, so I repeated it back to him to make sure I'd heard him right, recalling my partner's warning before I'd left San Francisco about drug cartels at the border. The driver confirmed that I'd heard him correctly, and I translated for my mother, father, brother, and cousin. No one in the cab protested, so we kept driving. We were on a quest to view the border wall prototypes constructed by Customs and Border Protection in response to then President Trump's 2017 executive order. Though the prototypes stand on the American side of the border, they're only visible from the Mexican side. U.S. citizens who paid for the prototypes are not allowed onto the land where they stand without special security clearance. So we came to Tijuana to see them for ourselves, to make them real, to bring ourselves to the problem. To find the prototypes, I'd brought directions I'd copied by hand from the website of a right-wing group that wants to make them a national monument. Finding a cab to take us there had been easy. The first and only cabbie waiting at the taxi stand outside the pedestrian bridge at the Otay Mesa crossing near San Diego had been willing. We negotiated a price and were on our way, making clear in our Norteño accents that we did not like Trump or his prototypes. I admit the driver's warning about men in the road made me nervous, but it was only one in a string of warnings that started as soon as I'd begun thinking out loud about making this trip. In San Diego, we heard warnings from strangers to remove jewelry and tales of vacationers being robbed at gunpoint as soon as they crossed the bridge. Now, hearing the cab driver calmly let us know men might block our way, I wondered if we'd made a mistake. But it was too late to turn back. We were already at the border, and yards away on the American side, we could see the prototypes looming. There are 8 of them. Each rises about 30 feet from the ground and has a barrier about 6 feet under. Each casts a shadow that is at least 500 miles long. I know because that's how far it is from San Francisco to San Diego, and that's how far their shadows need to stretch for me to feel them creeping over me. "If the police come," the driver told me before we got out of the car, "tell them you're seeing many things in Tijuana. You're not just here to see the prototypes. You are going to other places with many drivers. If they think you're just here to see this, they'll ask you for money." Again, I repeated it back in Spanish to make sure I had understood, and then told my family. We got out of the cab. We felt the full heat of the day and the dust in our throats. People live there, right there at the border wall. I don't know why this surprised me. The existing Mexican wall has been painted with murals that criticize Trump and call for peace. One painting shows a long table with a line drawn down the middle, people seated on the U.S. side and the Mexican side, eating together. While we were trying to get a photo of the prototypes in the distance, some of us standing on piles of trash to get a better angle, a man and a woman came out of their house and got into their car, waving as they drove away. Under a high-voltage electrical transformer, someone had hung swings where children could play. And then, through the dust and heat, we saw him, a man in the road. He was pushing an ice cream cart and coming right for us. The bell on his cart tinkled cheerfully. My dad treated us all, including the driver, to popsicles. I got the tamarind. Thank you for listening to part 3 of Good Fences Make Good Neighbors, or do they? The poem Affirmation, written by Asada Shakur, was read by Samantha Rogers and Lujain Asale. Music by Jamie Branch, Erwin Helfer, Mikey Dredd, Horde of Two, Marion Faithful, Megan Keeley, Bashar Al-Azawi and Raida Jawad, and Downtown Boys. We want to thank David Gallup, Katya Hoyer, Keon Charles, Patricia Salomi, Alex Hatch, and Irene Herman for their willingness to be part of this program. This show was produced by Emily Charles and Mary Salomi, a Queer in Your Ear production.